If you've watched my channel for a while, you know I go through my obsessions. And the current obsession that I'm having right now is, how did we get here in terms of science communication? Why is there this growing mistrust in experts and expertise across many fields of science, from climate to astronomy to virology? We are seeing sort of this pushback, both at a grassroots level, as well as even now a government and corporate level. You're seeing a lot of people who just don't respect, appreciate, believe in science. And this is puzzling to me as a giant science nerd. And I'm trying to figure out what's happening and how do we make it better? And I decided to talk to somebody who is on the front lines of this. My guest is Dr. Frederick Berkley. He is the president and CEO of COSI, which is the Center of Science and Industry. This is an amazing science center, science museum in Columbus, Ohio, widely considered one of the best in the United States. And he is there educating people, giving people hands-on experiments and ideas about science, and helping people who have really never had a chance in a formal way to learn about science to actually perform experiments. And of course, if you've ever been to a science museum, they are super fun for the whole family, and you get a chance to perform experiments that, you know, you're just not going to get a chance to do in your normal life. And so in this conversation, we start out pretty softball and talk about his experience as a science educator and the work that he does through COSI. But then we shift into what I am obsessed with. And that is, of course, how did we get here? What is the nature of the problem? And my hope is that most of you who are watching this are fans of science. You appreciate science, and you are experiencing the same kind of acute pain that I am watching science be mangled and be denied and be miscommunicated. And there are forces that are trying to undermine people's sort of expectations and understanding of how the scientific process works and how we got to our current levels of knowledge and how you can take action to better your life into the future. So if you want to hear a conversation about that, mostly that, enjoy my conversation with Dr. Frederick Berkley, or Dr. B. Frederick, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show.
So there's a couple of angles here that I want to sort of cover. But first, you, like me, are Canadian. Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up?
I'm a card-carrying Canuck. Grew up dans la belle province, in the province of Quebec, in the city of Montreal.
Oh, wow. And, what a great city.
When I say I'm a proud caring Canuck, I mean, I went through the whole Canadian education system, went to McGill University, proud alumni there, and then postdoctoral fellowship training took me across the border.
Yep. And you are now currently at COSI. So give us a sense of what that is.
Yeah, so COSI is COSI, stands for the Center of Science and Industry, and we celebrated our 60th year last year, so we're 61 years old, young, and basically, it's a science museum or science center. So if you think of American Museum of Natural History, the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, I don't know if it's still, I can't remember what it's called in Calgary, but certainly the Ontario Science Center, the Montreal Science Center, et cetera. We're a science museum.
Yeah, we had the big golf ball in Vancouver, the science center there.
Yeah, that's not the Rogers. I can't remember out west, but yes. But anyway, what's really neat about COSI, because we're located in Columbus, Ohio, and believe it or not, we're voted the number one science museum in the entire United States for 5 years.
Yeah. Now, longtime collaborator of mine, Dr. Paul Sutter, he was one of your scientists in residence there for a while there.
Absolutely. So, Dr. Sutter was the chief scientist at COSI, a phenomenal physicist, phenomenal astrophysicist, and my favorite, a phenomenal science communicator. So kudos for you all having him as a regular contributor.
Yeah. So what's your sort of, you know, what is the kind of mission of COSI?
So the mission of COSI is to engage, inspire, and transform lives and communities by being the best partner in science, technology, and industry learning. And that partnership is key. So we're a science museum. We don't have tons of PhD scientists doing cutting-edge research, but we're also not the general lay public. And so we're that bridge, and we have our impact. And frankly, the reason why we won the number one science museum for 5 years is because we partner with all kinds of organizations. And that's strategic. One, you can have a much bigger impact as a nonprofit institution if you're partnering with higher eds, with companies in the science and engineering field, as well as elected officials in the public space. But the other cool piece is it allows us to really be that bridge in science communication and science engagement, which is so needed, not just in the United States of America where I live, but in Canada and the Western society, in fact, around the world.
So, you know, I think a lot of us have probably had this experience of going into a science museum. There's a lot of sort of interesting exhibits that you can interact with that teach you some aspect of science, hands-on kind of tactile experiences. What do you find sort of are the best?
Well, one of the strategies that science museums and science centers have figured out is how to uncouple the sustain and difficulty for the average person to think about themselves as a scientist and make it fun and engaging. So for example, we all go to school. If you go to school in West Society, at some point you take some science courses, biology, physics, et cetera, but it's taught in a typical academic way. It's often very theoretical, devoid from our everyday breathing oxygen experience. And so what science centers decide is one, scrap a curriculum, two, forget about the time of day, three, let's make things hands-on because everybody knows doing is much better than I love to read and reading is fundamental to date myself, if you remember that line. So reading, of course, is important, but when you do stuff in a hands-on experiential way, you get more excited and the way the neurons are wired in your brain, you learn differently. And so what science centers done is stripped off all the tape and barriers to a typical education system and makes stuff fun. I mean, who doesn't want to see an engine cut through halfway and now you're looking at these pistons going, oh my gosh, that's how my car works, et cetera. So that's the sweet spot that informal science centers, science museums have figured out. It's we're going to deconstruct the scariness, the difficult to understandness of many of these scientific things and make it fun and engaging. And then you're like, wait a minute, I might follow this up through Google, read some more, maybe go check some other stuff out because I could actually experience it in a way that was engaging and enjoyable.
And I think I know what you mean. Like this, you know, I think there's this sort of book learning expectation of science as a bunch of facts you have to remember about the size of planet Earth and how the letters in DNA and all of that kind of stuff. But I think at heart, we're all scientists. We're all, you know, we go through this process of, you know, noticing something, coming up with a hypothesis, gathering evidence, testing it against our hypothesis, coming up with what we think is a conclusion, this kind of natural scientist. Do you think, is it almost like you have to sort of teach people that as they come in because they've been sort of improperly a sort of, they don't have the right understanding of how science works?
You're so spot on. One, to reverse engineer what you said, they don't have the right understanding of how scientists work. Or science works. And two, what you said at the beginning of this piece is we are all scientists. So first of all, your point about Book of Facts and all your, I'm sure all your guests say the same thing. Science is not a book of facts. It's not a collection of facts. Science is a process of having a question. It's very Socratic. In fact, you have a question, how does something work? Okay. Then you do some type of experiment, collect some kind of information / data, have an idea based on what the data showed you. And then you continue to iterate and collect more data and get closer to the truth of some natural phenomenon of some kind. So it's a process. And what's amazing to your quote, we actually are all scientists because we're born, we come out the womb, and what do we do in 12 months? Learn to crawl. So our first few years, by 2 years, we're standing up, running around. By 5 years, we have a vocabulary. We know how to ask for food. We know what to eat. Like that's an entire scientific process. That baby coming out the womb is analyzing this panacea around themselves as a microwave and making sense of it. And they're processing it. They're making conclusions moving forward. And so we are all innate scientists. And I love what you said. And I'll paraphrase it. What the typical K-12 education system does in Western society is beat that curiosity out of you and tell you you need to be this way. And that's where the wheels fall off the track.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really lucky when I went to engineering, my physics teacher would sort of intersperse the, you know, a blackboard full of notes with big dramatic science experiments where he would blow things up on stage.
Love
and that would, you know, and like, what do you think is going to happen? What do you predict is going to happen here? And a lot of it was very surprising. You'd be put in the situation where you would have to sort of expect, your instincts would tell you some response, like springs and things like that, where you expect one thing and then you wouldn't get that response. And now you're like, well, wait a minute, why? Okay, why? Now you're gonna have to learn the math, but it was all very good.
Three things. I love that too. That's why everybody loves Mark Roper. I mean, that's what he does,
right? Yeah.
In a large dramatic scale. But three, who doesn't like what you just described?
Mm-hmm.
Male, female, regardless of religion, regardless of ethnicity, everybody likes that surprise and delight when some phenomena happens. Like the coils. I mean, so what I don't understand, and maybe this is for another conversation, is where has the disconnect come with the typical, I want to say typical, because there's some amazing schools that are hands-on inquiry-based out there, right? But in general, the K through 12, even K through 16 undergrad, that space, where did the disconnect come that they went from really cool, engaging things that everybody likes to, you know, a really dense book or now really dense, you know, digital file with all this stuff? Yeah, you need to know formula, but understand and derive the formula rather than memorizing something and going backwards.
Yeah, and you kind of wonder, like instead of learning all of those facts, if you literally just spent an entire year teaching a person the scientific method, for example, and that's it, and then they could apply that to whatever they want, whatever's interesting to them or whatever's making them curious, then that would give them some really nice preparation to see at large how science actually functions as opposed to learn a bunch of facts.
That's right. And what kills me being scientific about the process, no pun intended, is we all have examples and analogies of schools and education systems that do that.
Yeah.
And we all know the kids who come out. I mean, look how you came out with your engineering experience and your physics teacher. I mean, you know, it's not that we're better people, but we really come out with a richer understanding of how to process things, how to analyze things, and how to problem solve in a useful way. Yet, despite all that scientific data of these examples of great education system, we still churn and burn in an antiquated space. And it's tough, and especially today with where we are with growing science illiteracy, and not just science illiteracy, but anti-science, it's more than ever important that we figure out a right way to educate the next generation.
Yeah, well, and I appreciate you setting up what is going to be sort of the next part of this conversation, which is the thing that I have been obsessing about is noticing, and it's happened over the last couple of years, is just this kind of growing anti-science rhetoric and a distrust in expertise in general. And, you know, your background is in immunology. You have sort of seen this right from the front lines. What's been your sort of perspective of this thing? And maybe, you know, are you seeing the same thing that I'm seeing?
Absolutely saying the same thing that you're seeing. And it's multifactorial, but the heaviest weight on the scale has little or less to do with do people really think science is interesting or not, or science is good or not. But the heavier weight on the scale that gets us out of whack is it's just become part of, and one of the big parts of, a political machine, or part of the political machine. And so if we talk about the US, we talk about coronavirus and COVID and the pandemic from 2020 beyond. You know, yes, there was a real virus. Yes, it infected us. Yes, it caused a big problem. But so much of the mess was political, and, you know. And so when you have the power of politics, which cannot be extricated from the power of money, that governs, dominates, and corrupts lots of people, but especially those who kind of weren't really into it or never really thought it was them, and the ones who could be influenced, they become way more influenced by the political angle and push to something versus the cool, neat, let's look at the science behind that. And so it's a combination of a marketing issue and a political and economically tied issue. And then the last thing is, and this is a shout out to my little tribe of scientists and engineers, we need to do a better, you know, back to Paul Sutter, that's why I appreciate him being on your program and all the other folks you have who write and contribute. We need to do more as scientists, as bona fide scientists and engineers, to get people excited and be not necessarily in opposition, but be a strong voice of what we do and tell our narrative. And a lot of times, and you know this, you know, science engineers, we're kind of quirky here. Sometimes we're introverted. We just want to do our little research, be at the Met, or develop our little program. I understand that. But if we have this whole other narrative being told by social media influencers and politicians and people who have axe to grind, but they have a voice in the following, it's going to really deconstruct the view of science as a process and as a whole important system. And in terms of our preliminary comments, is what moves humanity forward. I mean, without question, where humanity is today in 2025, about to be 2026, is that much better. You can do it in jumps of centuries if you want. It is literally better in all aspects of our lives as humans because of science and tech. And so, you know, if you take the richest king from the 17th century or even 18th century, you know, oh, they've got the castle and this and that. They're pooping in a bucket, man, catching diseases. They're walking around with fire sticks, you know? Like the poorest government housing places in Canada, Toronto, Jane and Finch, or in the US and wherever, they got flushing toilets, running water, you know, electricity, a safe heat. I mean, it's crazy, let alone these devices we have in our pockets that, you know, it's almost ubiquitous on the planet, regardless of first world or developing world nations. We all have these technological devices. So we have moved forward in incredible ways because of science and technology, yet it's being beaten up.
Mm. Yeah, well, like we are utterly dependent on this sort of modern society, and it comes from our understanding and sort of harnessing the science and the technology to get us where we're at this point. And yet it has become something that people are taking for granted and then are even sort of undermining the next generation of the people who are continuing and expressing any kind of enthusiasm for this work.
100%.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say 100%. And imagine, they do all that, driving their electric cars and using this device in their hands and social media and all the technology that allows them to communicate, yet they're bashing it. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you mentioned it's sort of like there's this mash of like politics getting into it and economic forces and so on. And it's weird. Like we're at this time where, for example, all of the growth in the U.S. economy is essentially driven by investments in the large technology firms for developing these gigantic large language models, these data warehouses, and so on. And that is a bet on technology. That is essentially a bet on science, saying, okay, this is this scientific thing that very few people understand, and yet we are literally betting our economy on this thing. And then at the same time, almost in on the one hand, they're spending all this money on this thing. And then on the other hand, they are contributing to the undermining of the science that got you to this thing. Mm-hmm. I understand.
Yeah, well, I do want to, you teased it up a little bit, but I do think we should unpack it a little more. There was a Malcolm Gladwell tipping point with this science illiteracy, science anti-bashing, and that's the pandemic. So before the pandemic, you definitely had people who were like, you know, far on the left and like, you know, tinfoil hats and think science is a thing, what have you. But that was a small percentage of points. And that's always going to be the case, right? You're always going to have a Gaussian distribution. There's always going to be people on the fringes. That's fine. But then you had other people who were like, maybe not into science, but if you caught them and spoke to them, you could get them a little excited. What the pandemic did is it took science, which for most people, not necessarily your listeners and followers, but for most people, science was this, I'm getting your screen, science was this abstract thing that, you know, allowed cool stuff, agriculture, you know, can allow me to have a clean home, produce technology, I can communicate, right? All right, medicine's the same level ones. But most people weren't interacting in science or weren't really impacted by science until somebody got sick or whatever. What the pandemic did is that little virus impacted the entire planet, or darn near the entire planet, and which is one thing. But everybody's lives, again, 99% of lives on planet Earth, we're not a little bit altered. We're completely affected.
Right. You're now stuck inside. You lost your job.
There you go.
Your expenses went up. People were telling you.
Yeah. There you go. And so you in Western society felt it in a way that none of us in 100 years have ever felt anything like that. And it's caused not because of terrorism, not because of a war, not that those things would be okay, but not because of any of these other things, but because of a bug. And oh my God, what's the answer? The scientist. Tell me what to do. Tell me what's going on. And that's where the wheels really fell off, because we as scientists didn't stick true to who we are, which is, guess what? I don't know. What I'm going to do, experiments to gather information and get me closer to the truth. So, you know, of course we know a lot about virology and vaccines and all that stuff, but we never had this vaccine, this virus, coronavirus, in humans. And so we didn't really know how it was going to respond. And by the way, because we never had this specific bug in humans, there's no immunity for it. So what was going to happen? There were two possible outcomes of the pandemic. One, everybody would get infected and it would kill off a whole bunch of people and some lucky survivors would repopulate the earth. Or, this is true, this is not fantasy, or, and this is what happened, or we'd figure out a way to come up with a vaccine and then that would slowly suppress the virus out there in the environment, get herd immunity, and then slowly, you know, it's still here with us, of course, but now it's controllable. All right.
Right, right. But like, to be fair, that first outcome that you described, even if we had never developed a vaccine, it would have been, you know, it would be millions of deaths, not the end of humanity, but it would be, you'd be counting in the millions, tens of millions of deaths. Like I think that, you know, what the vaccines get you is you slow the curve, you make it so that people don't need to die unneedlessly, and that still people are going to die. And a lot of people died. Like, yeah. The numbers are huge, and yet it's less than could have been.
Yeah.
And I think you're right that. That when you think about, I don't know, like I read about people talking about whether or not you should drink coffee, right? And you're like, well, coffee's good for you. Coffee's bad for you. Coffee's good. You know, and you ask a scientist, you're like, is coffee good for me or not? And they're like, I don't know. I mean, you know, we've got these papers that tell us one thing. We've got those papers that tell us this other thing. You know, it's probably, you know, the fact that we're having trouble, it's, you know, it means that it's probably not extreme one way or the other.
And that's
We'll get back to you in 10 years and we'll give you a better answer then. Until then, you know, drink your coffee, don't drink your coffee, whatever. And I think you're exactly right. The people were going like, okay, tell us what to do because this might be scary. And the right answer is, we don't know. We're gathering information. We're going to let you know. We're going to try and then we're going to try and speak to you in the scientific terminology as we have come to understand it. And uncertainty is the, you know, is the companion of the scientist. And that is the thing that people don't want, is uncertainty.
Exactly. Yeah. And because if it was an intellectual exercise, it would have been like, oh, okay, whatever. But because people were like, wear the mask, don't wear the mask, da, 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 and we as scientists were flip-flopping, and we weren't flip-flopping. It looks like that through rose-colored glasses, but in reality, we were gathering more information, and oh, it's like, oh, we weren't right. Oh, never mind. And as we got on, you don't hear anybody today about saying wearing a mask or not wearing a mask. Like, we're more definitive because we have more information, but the public, to your point, didn't understand or appreciate the scientific process, and because they were at home, as you said, locked up, can't hang out with their friends, can't go out to the restaurant, can't do and live a normal life, the people they're mad at are scientists. And that really, in my mind, added gasoline on this anti-science, distrust of science. Oh, I'm not feeling the scientific community anymore, because that experience was visceral for the average person. And they were blaming two people, the politicians and the scientists. And the politicians, you know, they were classically blamed. The scientists in this instance were blamed, and they were the experts on something that's harming my life, and they weren't sure, and they changed their mind. You know what? I can't trust scientists anymore. And that, unfortunately, has stuck. And that's the big problem, Fraser. It's stuck, right? The pandemic, we're out of the pandemic, but it's still stuck.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were forces working before the pandemic. You know, I sort of think about, you know, I report on stuff about space. Planet Earth is in space. Sometimes we report on planet Earth. Earth has an atmosphere. We report on the state of the atmosphere, climate change, things like that. And I would get sometimes thousands of comments. Like, maybe I get three comments on an article about I don't know, the Andromeda Galaxy. And then I would get 1,000 comments on an article about climate change.
Yep.
And you'd be like, wait a minute. And a lot of this looks very similar. Like, and we now know, you know, the books have been written have sort of told us that there were, you know, financed disinformation campaigns to try to undermine people's sort of belief in climate science. Mm-hmm.
You just answered your question right there, or answered the point right there. You talked about the Andromeda Galaxy, get maybe three things. You talked about climate science, boom. What's the difference there? How many politicians have ever written anything about the Andromeda Gal? How many politicians have lobbied and
wish they do more
talk about the Andromeda Gal? None. Yeah. Zero.
Yeah.
Yet on climate change, it's been funded out the yin yang. Why? Because there's a lot of money at stake if we really say it's a real thing. And the solution is cutting back. And oh, there goes some of my. So you actually, it's really funny how you teed that up with your writings that come in. It's literally directionally proportional to politics and money.
So then, is it that for the longest time, science wasn't sort of running up against people's experiences and sort of hampering their lifestyle in a rapid way? Or is it that the actual sort of the science that is sort of becoming sort of, I don't know, sort of critical for people's lives is changing? You know, because again, we've talked about there's a long history. Science has changed our lives. We fly in the air. Like, bird, yeah, you know, that's faster than a bird. It's crazy. That's a
great question.
Yeah.
For me, it's always been there. It's just at a different scale because information is much more accessible and much more instant. And what I mean by that is, remember, what they do to Galileo, he basically pooped on Christianity and saying, what? The planet is round? And, right, like, he was like, whoa. And so there was massive opposition there. But, you know, the information was much more glacial as it got to people or whatever. But what do they do with him? They killed the dude, right? I mean, that.
Well, they put him in house arrest.
Well, essentially, they shut down his life, right?
Yeah.
My point was, he was a scientist, and he was met with massive opposition, again, by who? The power brokers back in the day, in that instance, were religious figures. Today's power brokers are the big corporations or elected officials or lobbyists, et cetera. So that same dynamic was there. But today we feel it a lot more because we have these computers in our pocket that give us global information instantly. And then also everybody has a voice. So you can chime out your opinions while you couldn't really do that in the Galileo period.
So do you think that scientists learned valuable lessons during the pandemic about how to communicate with the public while also staying true to their scientific principles?
You know, again, I'll call them my tribe. These are my people. These are your people. I got to say, I wish, you know, if I was a hopeful optimist, sure. But it's been a lot of years. And what happens is people like Paul Sutter, people like Neil deGrasse Tyson, people like you name it, you know, whoever's out there science communicating, they're doing more. You know, you're pushing your foot on the gas pedal. So the people that were in that space are doing more of it and being very sensitive about it. But I haven't seen a cascading significant change in the number of bench scientists or engineers that are saying, hey, wait a minute, give me a megaphone too. I got something to say and I want to share this. Or let me have a podcast or let me add a more stuff on LinkedIn or what have you. It's not just those who do this kind of are doubling down and see why this is important. See why we need to have more Fraser Cain programs. See when, you know, because we know it and we understand how bad, to your point, it was during the pandemic. But I mean, I'd love to hear your opinion, but I don't feel like the Delta has been significantly changed to recruit more. I'm talking about basic scientists and hardcore engineers into the science communication space.
There are a few people who I think are like absolutely terrific gold star communicators. You know, I think of a few examples. Mm-hmm. Probably my favorite is a guy named David Kipping. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
He runs the Cool World
Lab at Columbia. Wow. He is on the one hand a astronomer who is leading a team of people working on cutting edge search for exomoons. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it runs a YouTube channel, will opine on various subjects. He will present his latest science paper in a way that sort of builds up your understanding of, you know, he uses it in the terminology of science, mm-hmm. talks about his Bayesian probabilities,
right.
And at the same time will sort of come to a conclusion and people will be very excited and enthusiastic and sort of love to watch the science at work. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, if there was like a model of somebody who I think is kind of doing it exactly right, it's someone like David Kipping. And there are similar people in various fields that I think – but it's like, it's almost like it's asking too much of the scientist because you're saying, do your work as a scientist mm-hmm. and then do the work as a communicator who understands the science and is willing to show people how the sausage gets made. And then I think if you don't have a person like David Kipping, and then, you know, the analogies in other fields, you get, say, a Neil deGrasse Tyson or a Paul Sutter, or, you know, who are scientists who have now gone on to communication full time. They understand the material, but they're focusing on the science, on the communication. They're not doing the science anymore.
Yeah.
And then you have a person like me, you know, I have a scientific background, but I'm 100% just communication.
Sure.
And then you have the scientists, and that's the vast majority. That's the tens of thousands of people who are just doing the science, and they don't want to be bothered to communicate. And it is almost unreasonable to ask them to do so. And
man,
so
I loved how you yeah. framed that. Let's reverse engineer this.
Yeah, let's dismantle that. Yeah.
Absolutely unreasonable to ask them to do so. Now, in the case of Kipping, he nailed it. And I do want to say, remember, your question was, since the pandemic, do we have more? And for me, Kipping and the ones like Kipping, like you said, per discipline, oh, they've been doing that. That's what they've been doing. He didn't hop onto that because of that. So that's what I'm saying. I haven't seen the needle move too much since the pandemic of having more David Kippins or even having more Paul Sutters or Neil deGrasse Tyson. And I love how you bucketed all of them. What's most important is we're suffering, and this is what pains me. Almost everything we have that makes us comfortable on planet Earth, and I don't have to go through the monologue with you, has been made possible because of science and engineering. And yet the average person out there, and I do this all the time, you probably do this too, when you're in a crowd of 1,000 people, 500 people, and you ask them, name a scientist, who do they say? Albert Einstein. And if you ask the general public to name a female scientist, who do they say? Marie Curie. And if it's Black History Month, oh dear God, and you ask for a scientist, they say, oh, this peanut guy, I can't remember, oh, George Washington Carver. Like, think about that. Yeah, it's all around. Yeah, you ask that same crowd, who's the best 5 basketball players? Boom, football players, singers, Celine Dion, Taylor Swift. Like, they know everything about everything else. But the thing that makes us most alive and healthy and keeps us going inside, we don't know that. All right, why is that important? Because every other sector has a different energy and engine that does the stuff you're talking about. What am I talking about? Kipping, perfect example. He does everything. That, to your point, is not fair to ask the average scientist and they're going to do that. But look at the rest of the industry. Football. Is it football players that are doing stuff? Yeah, Tom Brady might have his little social media, might send a tweet. But it's the Patriots' marketing and communication arm. You know, pick the Montreal Canadiens. Those athletes aren't sitting there talking about it. It's this whole engine and communication. You can go on field after field after field. Look at the average artist or actor. They got like acting studios or homes or engines or, you know, 5 deep science, not science, what do they call them? Public relations person. You got a whole team of people that handle their communication messaging. And they're like, Taylor, just go out and, you know, sing on stage and then every now and then send a tweet. Right. And so, but science doesn't have that. Now flip this. Imagine every major university in Western society, Canada, US, you know, Europe, wherever. Imagine every major university had a massive, not a little one person, because everybody's got a communication person, department, but had a massive communication engine about the science and inventions and patents and stuff coming out of pretty much every university. Like, that would be really cool, but we don't have that. And so that's, so you nailed it. It's just for some reason, and I don't know what it is, science has somehow been exploited and appreciated in terms of it drives us forward, but the love that other industry sectors get is not there. And I used to think it was because of money, but it's not money, because you nailed it. What's driving the United States and Canada and much of the world moving forward? You know, it's not oil money anymore. I mean, it's still there. And it is what you said, science and tech, AI, and it, right? Like, so it's got all this money.
Yes.
We don't have that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. You're exactly right. That you're going to have, you know, all this public relations machine that is helping, say, the football player, so that they can focus on working out, getting mm-hmm. faster, mm-hmm. learning how to play the game and be the best version of themselves that they can be. Mm-hmm. And then maybe helping cover up when they, you know, goof say up some stuff that's a little excessive out in public or whatever, right? Like, you've got that support. Mm-hmm. But when you think about, say, the public relations that's available at a university or at NASA, you know, one person who's there to support the entire science department of a university, or maybe like 3 people that are there to support the entire university and all of the work that it does. And, you know, one of the things that I sort of, my bread and butter is to look in journals for interesting research that has not been reported through a press officer yet, because that's where all the gems are. I want to report the stuff that nobody's talking about. And that's because, and I think it's so sad because it's an amazing story. And all it took was somebody at the university to just go, hey, tell me what you're working on. Tell me what you're working on. What are you working on? Oh, I'm working on, you know, we just found a runaway supermassive black hole. That sounds interesting. Let's write a, you know, let's write a story about that. That is threadbare across universities and probably even getting cut back more and more as we speak. But is that because, like, there's no financial incentive? Like again, all the money is going to this, yet none of the money is going to support this and help educate people about it compared to something that is very profitable. Like, is it that it's private versus public?
No way. It is the greatest emperor wears no clothes thing that has ever happened in society, and it's impacting us as scientists and engineers in the field. I'll give an example. I live here in Columbus, Ohio. All right. Now, there's this university that actually, by law, won the argument, and now they're known as the Ohio State, and you better capitalize T-H-E, and they got a trademark for that, so they're known as the Ohio State. Well, why is that relevant to this conversation? Ohio State's got one of the best football programs in the country. Fine, they're great, dude. They won the national championship last year. It's all buzz right now in Columbus and Ohio because they're making a run for it again this year. All right. And people are like, oh, because of the money, whatever. All you see everywhere in 100 miles radius from where I'm sitting is the Ohio State Buckeyes. Like, football, 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 everything. And yes, it generates a lot of money for the college. I know this. Guess what the largest donation was to the Ohio State University? It was about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, from a Russian, a person who's from Russia, did his engineering degree at Ohio State as undergrad, ended up starting a tech company, made a boatload of money. He gave, I think it's $111 or $112 million to the institution. Right? So that's A. B, you look at the tech, and then people talk about the football and there's a football program, but their engineering school at The Ohio State, their agricultural school, their the medical research centers, they are crushing it and transforming the world with amazing inventions and discoveries. Everybody talks about football. So it's not money. There are spades of money, right? And like, again, you talk about the athletes, the program, you know, yes, collectively, the football team brings in maybe, I don't know if it's $60 or $80 million a year. That's a lot of money that funds a lot of the other teams. But one person gave $110 million.
NVIDIA's worth $6 trillion right now.
Well, there you go.
$6 trillion.
Can you imagine? So there you go. So it's not about money. That's why, you know, part of it is, well, not part. I always say it's a marketing thing. If whoever threw a lot of money and brought some really clever, intelligent marketing people to this problem, I'm not saying we would match Taylor Swift or Michael Jordan, LeBron James, but it would be really different because, you know, so cool. And then a bigger piece, by the way, is it's really hard for me to be the next great running back on the Ohio State Buckeyes, let alone make it to the NFL. Right? We know the stats. And not that being an engineer or scientist like you or me is easy, but it's a whole lot easier. You do okay in high school, get to college, study a little bit. You know, you might not be Marie Curie or whoever name, you know, insert, you know, current scientist, but you could be a scientist or an engineer and have a great career. Whereas the odds of me, I love football and I love hockey, but the odds of me being the next, you know, Guy Lafleur, to give a Montreal throwback quote, or the next LeBron James, or Tom Brady. Yeah, that's slim to none.
Yeah. And I think, so, you know, one of the things that I always say is about how nature will reveal the truth in time, that, you know, the things that we're doing to the environment, what we're doing to the climate, that, you know, you can spin it however you want. You can have funding from the oil companies, whatever that is doing their marketing. But in the end, the temperatures are going to rise. You know, where I live in Canada, we have a glacier that hangs over my city on Vancouver Island, and the glacier's almost gone. And it is like, it's on our, if you welcome to the Comox Valley, there's this glacier, this picture of the glacier, and they're going to have to change the picture, you know, the artwork that welcomes you to the valley, because we're about to lose our glacier. Probably in the next, probably 2-3 years, it's going to be gone.
Oh my goodness, you're killing me.
Yeah. It's, and then like, I feel like I want to just stand out with a sign going, remember when we used to have a glacier? Because it is like, it is the identity of this city that we have this glacier. Wow. And we're about to lose this glacier. But then you have, you know, a lot of this other kinds of stuff in terms of you know, epidemics where people die and, you know, people in your life die, or people die of cancers or Alzheimer's or all these diseases that are happening, and that we can, you can lead this kind of marketing campaign against reality. And yet in the end, it kind of has to snap. And you can see sort of examples, and that was the one, the personal example for me, but you can see, for example, people who are gamers, and they're no longer able to buy RAM at a reasonable price for their computers because the data centers have gobbled them all up. And so now the price of RAM has gone up, changed the price of computers. It's suddenly a totally different world. And that's because all of this investment is going into science, and yet you don't have the investment into the net next generation of people. Like, if there was scientists in the pipeline, then you wouldn't hit these resource constraints in the same way, because you would have the support, the next generation support coming along. And and we're going to feel this in lots of different ways in our daily lives.
Listen, I'm glad you recorded that. That was a thesis on what's going on. You're nothing to add. You're spot on. Yeah. And it's gut-wrenching. I can add that. It's gut-wrenching to see that happen, but you're spot on.
Yeah. And I think that, but unfortunately, people are going to spin the realities in a way that continues to push whatever there is their political narrative, right? You know, that if another pandemic comes, another pandemic comes along, did we learn from the one that we just had, or did we learn the exact opposite lesson? You know, you're watching measles outbreaks. How are you taking that?
Okay, see, now you're poking the bear. All right. So imagine this. One of the best tested vaccines in the history of vaccine biology is the measles vaccine, MMR, or even broken up. It's been around forever. And in short, it is without question, completely and totally safe, period. Right? Because different vaccines come in, newer vaccines, okay, you might need a longer tail. How are they doing it? Measles is not one of them. The vaccine works and it's safe. All right, fine. Now imagine this. If you take your child, if you have a baby, and you drive your car and you throw the baby in the backseat and you don't put the baby in a child seat and the police stop you, minimum, you're going to get a citation, but you could even get locked up. I could go to court for child endangerment, except in other words, we have laws that protect babies. Why? Because a baby can't speak for him or her themselves. They're a little kid that can squeak, but they can't say, hey, put me in a safe seat, man. I'm worried about a guy crashing. So we develop laws to protect them. Yet we have zero laws against parents. Well, we have some vaccine mandates here and there. If you're in schools, kids got to be vaccinated. But in general, we don't arrest the parent or give a parent a citation if that same baby that couldn't choose to be in a car seat couldn't choose for themselves to get a vaccine. The parent who's educated, usually liberal, got one or two degrees and thinks they're smarter than all the immunologists and scientists out there. And they're making decisions, say, nope, too risky. I'm not risking that. So think about that. And so you have, to your point about measles, today in Canada, a little bit, and a lot in the US, consistent outbreaks of measles where children literally die. Now, I'm not going to speak about religious exemptions. I'll leave that alone to people who have religiously. But, you know, I'm not saying it's right or not. I'm not going to touch that. But outside of that, I mean, how do you feel as a parent that your kid died of measles at the age of 1.5 or 2 because you were smarter than 80 years of scientific evidence to say I'm not giving vaccine? So it's a problem. And that's why I say there's the issue of, okay, science communication is fun, neat, okay. But really, secondarily, what you just talked about earlier, the more we have better science and engineering education, the more scientists and engineers will get. They'll create more stuff. Product of everything will come down in terms of price, and accessibility will be more ubiquitous. And then thirdly, we got some crazy decisions that are literally causing death. And I know we didn't get the FDA, but a lot of the sweeping changes that are happening in the country I live in, the United States of America, because of who's leading this whole kind of health political field, it's going to lead to people suffering at a minimum and some people even dying. And it's tragedy because these are preventable.
So is it a sort of a, there's a saying, and I forget exactly how this goes, but the gist is that you go up the stairs in rough shoes and you come down in slippers, that you know, we in sort of in the West, yep. we are so powerful and successful and highly technological. And we have all of this science in terms of medicine, you know, our teeth don't rot out of our faces anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of amazing to be alive at this time. Mm-hmm. And that is because we exist, you know, stand on the shoulders of giants, hundreds of years of people who are dedicating their lives to this scientific discovery. And it was seen as a good thing. Mm-hmm. And then you get to this place where, okay, now people are questioning and undermining it and taking away funding from it. And you sort of think back to people who had like polio 75 years, 100 years ago, and then they came up with the polio vaccine. And like, people were lined up. They knew how terrible the polio vaccine was, and they how terrible polio was, and they couldn't wait to get it in their bodies to remove the risk of them potentially getting polio. And so will the pendulum swing the other way, where things just get so bad, you're like, oh, right, science was important all along?
I mean, it's funny, you know, about 20 minutes ago, you said a statement, which is absolutely true. Things normalize, and nature runs its course. So right now, the pendulum has swung completely in the United States, and that massive arc and swing is because of the geopolitical stuff happening. So definitely, it will come back towards the medium. I don't know how fast, and I don't know, you know, I don't know if the damage that's been done both during and post-COVID from people being more cautious, as a soft term, or angry, as a stronger term of science, that in combination with the deleterious, negative, and massive anti-science campaign, a lot of which you articulated, and the consequences, you know, these things might have a long tail. I don't know. So the pendulum will come back, but A, how much is it going to come back to a more normalized, central place? And B, how long is this damage? I mean, I'll shift away from science for a minute. When you talk about how people treat each other, current leadership in this nation has literally made it okay to be the biggest butthole to other citizens. The stuff we say, the stuff we do, it's a license to be the biggest jerk on the planet. Like, we wouldn't have, 10 years ago, even 8 years ago, but 10 years ago, the stuff that you see on TV and stuff that these leaders, it would never have been tolerated, but it's being tolerated. So I don't know how fast it's going to swing back to the center. But to your point, eventually, look, nature wins. So eventually, you know, eventually it's going to come out. It's just hopefully we didn't, you know, make ourselves extinct before darn thing came back.
But how do we soften the blow? Because, you know, if nature is the ultimate arbiter, in the end, nature is going to tell you whether or not vaccines work, whether the measles are bad, whether climate change is real, and so on and so forth. How do we soften the blow? Because I think that's really what it's about. I think that's what was trying to happen during the pandemic, is that the scientists were saying, you know, this is not just an academic question. This is something that's going to have a real effect on real lives. What can we do? How can we flatten the curve? How can we make the limited resources that we have be available to other people? And so, you know, if we feel that, okay, you know, if you're going to distrust science, you know, nature is still there. She is going to be the ultimate arbiter. How do we help soften whatever impact could come in the future?
Two answers to that. One is you can subscribe to the Elon Musk or hop on Elon Musk bandwagon and colonize Mars and get the heck out of here and start over.
Go to Mars. Okay. All right. We'll put that option one. Sure.
Put that in the margin. Well, that's where science communication, all jokes aside, is absolutely critical. And despite my earlier pontification, the most important thing is dialogue, discourse, right? And what has happened now in this scientific community and lay community is there's been such a polarization of the scientists, where the knowledge people in ivory towers and they use these big Latin words and we think we're smarter than everybody else. And then the lay people who are like intimidated by science. And what we have to do is, you know, be vulnerable. And this is one of the strategies I do when I communicate science to the audience, is you really, and it sounds corny, but it's so effective. You need to meet people where they're at. So if somebody has a crackpot idea about a vaccine or climate science or GMOs or whatever it is, respect that they have that opinion. Don't try to make fun of them. Don't try to be condescending. Once you do that, you've lost them and they'll double down and we'll never be able to flatten that curve. But once you basically you respect that other person and they and you can tell, man, you're an educator. You can tell when you connect with somebody and they're appreciating you because you're respecting their point of view and opinion. You may not be agreeing, but you're respecting them. It's almost like a psychological solution to what you're looking for, more so than a didactic, let's do science. It's communication and meeting people where they're at, respecting them, understanding where they're coming from, and then trying to unpack where they got these ideas in a non-condescending way and get them to see, hey, here's something else to think about. And if you do this, not the perfect solution that works every time, but more often than not, that gets people to at least listen to you.
Yeah. And,
yeah.
I have a friend who, you know, perhaps should not watch as many videos on Facebook as you should. And so, and yet we like meet once a week for coffee and have a grand old time.
Okay.
And, you know, some of that time is spent just sort of addressing some of the recent, you know, conspiracy theories that he's been made familiar with. Mm-hmm. And yet I think we really enjoy each other's company so much and sort of meet across what is probably political boundaries and all that to find these moments of common ground. He's my best friend.
Okay.
And I think that we've sort of also reached this place where you have this sort of disconnection between these tribes where people are like, okay, you know, you used to say things were disagreeable. Now you're kind of evil and I can no longer chat with you, interact with you. And in fact, the people who are trying to make the bridges and go across are evil as well. And so then it's sort of, people are very unwilling to stick their neck out and say, okay, hey, person who I deeply disagree with, let's sit down, have coffee, let's chat about the things, let's find the points of common ground, and then let's move forward, try and come up with solutions to these problems. That's becoming less and less of what is the natural path forward. And so, you know, what you're saying sounds great. Hey, all we need to do is just, you know, meet people where they are and share blah, blah, blah. But in fact, there is sort of an enforcement arm that exists within even the separate groups that is making it really hard for people who are trying to build those bridges across what is now a divide that is widening.
100%.
And you know, you kind of have to run against not only the people who you're trying to talk down from an anti-science perspective, now you're also dealing with potentially the judgment of the people who should be on your side because you're not going about it the right way.
Yep. So to that point, first of all, well said again, to that point, and I'm not comparing ourselves to this, but that's what Mother Teresa went through. That's what Gandhi definitely went through. And that's certainly what Jesus went through, right? I mean, it's tough. It's tough, hard work. You know, you call it, the gap is much bigger. And it's, you know, if I were to be scientific about it, I would be like, you know what? Forget this, man. Diminishing returns. This is just, I'm done.
Yeah,
like, you
know, exactly. And that's what they do, right? Maybe. I'm just going to work on my science.
That's right. 50 years later, maybe. But right now, I got this many decades left in my life. I'm going to work on what I want to do and keep it moving, right? But there's part of me that wants to be like, just, okay, just keep trying. But no, you're right. I mean, you laid it out perfectly. And that's, for me, it's sad because it's about an almost pure thing. The idea of having a question, thinking about that question, finding some kind of way to collect information, data of that question to help you move towards an answer to your question. That's such a beautiful, you know, pure thing. For that to be corrupted into what you talked about, and then you're right, your own tribe is hating on you for reaching across the aisle. It's like, you can't win. So I hear you. I mean, I don't want to end on a tough negative space, but it's hard work. It's tough work.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the... I mean, I don't think anybody can walk away with some suggestions from this conversation. It's like, it's hard work. We got here and now we have to get out, and it's going to take both sort of peace and understanding and compassion from both the people who are trying to make these connections across the aisle, but as well as the people who are watching the people who are trying to make those connections and from both sides. And hopefully we do this before nature delivers its verdict across various fronts. Frederick, what are you obsessed with right now?
Real quick, before I get to what I'm obsessed with right now, because, oh, that list is so long, I'm going to have to pick one. To just close the last piece you said, you know, you're right, and it's, we're both right. It's really hard work. But I have to tell you, different context, but same kind of context. There's so much divisiveness here in the United States. And I got to tell you, I lived in this country when 9/11 hit. And we'll get into what, you know, what 9/11 was. But when that hit, and I have to tell you, I mean, there's obviously a tenor of anti-Muslim, and that, you know, that was real. But even with that, the entire country of the United States of America got together, you know, put race in there, put gender, put orientation. They were like, this is crazy. We got to work together and try to get through this. It was an amazing experiment and experience. And it's like, we were able to do that then. And then it gets back to these tribes you're talking about. In terms of what am I obsessed with?
Well, but sorry, I just want to continue that. You know, I think, you know, as a Canadian during that period, we were instrumental in helping sort of give people who were on their way to the US land in Newfoundland.
Yep.
And I never felt prouder,
right,
as a in that relationship that we have with the United States in this moment where the US suffered this terrible crisis. We were best friends and we, yep, did everything we could do to pitch in and help.
Absolutely.
Out. And I think that, you know, obviously sort of where we're at right now with the Canadian US relationships is strained to say the least, but there was a moment when COVID was unfolding that it felt like it was going to be another version of that.
Yep.
That there was like this applause for the healthcare workers. There, mm-hmm, was this kind of this call for people asking, what can we do? How can we change? How can we lessen the impact?
Mm-hmm.
And then for somehow that was seen, I don't know, after the fact, as like a negative. Like people think back of it and go, oh, it was brutal. It was, you know, I had to be inside. I had to make all these compromises and my children didn't learn. And what could have been a moment of bringing everybody together and sort of somehow drove them apart. And it felt like it happened almost a little after, like there was this moment in the beginning where it was all coming together. Whoop. And then there were some missteps, I think.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
By the healthcare people and the educators and government officials and all that. And then I think it sort of came out another way and it didn't have to. And I think in other countries, you look at what happened in China, you look at what happened in places like Thailand and stuff. Yeah. It stuck as let's pull together and let's get through this together as a community. So, I don't know.
There are some lessons learned and some lessons that are still scratching your head, trying to figure out. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
I ask the question again. What are you obsessed with?
Again, there's so many, but I'll pick one. And that's, I'm obsessed with cognitive dissonance, which connects with a lot about what we talked about today. Like, I don't ever pretend to be the smartest person in the room. I don't ever pretend to be the smartest person on the planet, obviously. If I'm not the smartest person in the room, I can't be the smartest person on the planet. But for me, and my father used to hate when I would use the word obvious, because he would say, it's obvious to you, but it doesn't mean it's obvious to the rest of the universe, right? Fair. But cognitive dissonance, when you're provided completely reasonable, sensible data that's been verified, clear, how do you still look at that data set or that information and be like, cool, nope, I'm going to believe this over here? And I understand the psychology behind it and how it's hard to change it, but I get all that kind of surface stuff. But at the deeper level, that I'm obsessed with that, because that leads, and it's not just about science, with how people view sexual orientation, how people view, you insert problem in the world here, that, look, let's, I don't want to get into politics and certainly don't want to get into religion, but Israel-Palestine, those bridges will not meet. It's not gonna, right? Cognitive dissonance, it's one side or the other. And so I'm obsessed with that because I want to believe that, and there's enough examples of that, that we have the capacity with our 86 billion neurons to be more open to looking at stuff and changing opinion, you know, but everything from hubris and ego and all that stuff gets in the way. But cognitive dissonance, that's what I'm absolutely obsessed with, because I think if we could solve that, so many problems, sir, would be better because of it.
Yeah, it's very interesting to sort of hear people have a debate where both parties are debating, like, they're actually taking the debate seriously and they're doing their level best to carry on their side of the argument, that it either comes down to it ended up that they weren't defining their terms properly, or one of them was experiencing some level of cognitive dissonance and then is brought over to the other side once the pieces kind of come together. But unfortunately, most debates are not held where people are sincerely, they're sincerely held beliefs. There are debates where people are just looking to score points and
points and clicks.
Yeah, exactly. Points and clicks. And which is really too bad, because having a conversation with a person who you disagree with and you being able to kind of get down to the bottom, the very heart of the moments of disagreement between you and that other person, you realize it's not very much in general. You know, you both experience reality. You both understand mostly what's going on. What? There are these points of disagreement that you can get down to the bottom of it. It's only when you try to then take it to the next level and try to get, as you say, you know, clicks and likes and clicks and that it goes off the rails and you're no longer having a debate and you're just kind of trying to score points for your team.
Yep. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But you do not get to go away. I know that's your favorite kind of denouement, you know, rhyming couplet question, but I got to ask you, sir, what are you obsessed with?
Well, you just experienced it. So, you know.
That's the program.
Yeah. So one of the things, like, I get people will often ask, like, my background is in computer science officially. You know, that's my degree. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I've been a space science journalist now for 25 years. And I will get, you know, I will do these live chats where I answer people's questions about space and astronomy. And I will often get someone saying, you know, what is your opinion on Roger Penrose's theory of cyclic universe? And I'm like, okay, I'm just a journalist. I am not equipped to have an opinion about his work. I am, you know, I can tell you what the scientific consensus is, but I cannot go any deeper than that. Yep. I'm a fancy large language model, I guess. Yep.
And kudos to you for being able to say that.
Yeah, totally, totally. And I think that where this comes down to is, I think people are very quick to espouse an opinion about a thing that they have not put in the time and the energy and the effort to learn about. And that in many cases, that if you went, you know, if you're like, dark matter's not real, it's just some, you know, fudge that the scientists made up to make their equations work. Like, okay, if you went and like actually did the work to get to the place where you now understood dark matter and you put in the time, then you would be in the same place that they would be. You would have made all the observations. Nature would have been telling you the reality and you would have gotten there too. So because we can't learn about all this stuff all at the same time, the best thing that we can do to short circuit it is to ask somebody who just did. Right? Ask an expert, ask a person who just dedicated their lives to this fundamental question. And if one person isn't enough, talk to 1,000, talk to the scientific consensus. And so in general, the safest way to live your life is to trust in the scientific consensus, right?
Amen.
And yet that is the thing. I say those words, and I know some segment of my audience, the one whoever's left after we've sort of scared them all away, that there's this segment who says, you know, that is bananas. Why would you trust the scientific consensus? That's just a bunch of people in the hive mind who are singing from the same songbook in lockstep under the pocket of big science. No, I'm going to do my own research. Great. Do your own research. Go get your PhD. You know, like either path you want to take, you should get to the right answer. The one that you don't get to do is where you don't actually do your research. You just form an opinion without learning the underlying reality.
Yep. No, absolutely well said.
Yeah. So that's one. And so I'm obsessed right now with how do we fix this? How do we get back to this place where science is seen as the powerful tool that it is, both good and bad, that we can appreciate it for its both the wonders that it has given us and also the dangers that we face because of our increasing scientific capability. And how do we make good rational choices about our future? That's what I'm obsessed with right now. That's this month. December's almost over though, so I'm sure next month it'll be butterflies or something. I don't know.
Well, still with that angle and with that lens, I got to tell you, keep that pulpit going, sir, because we just need more of this. We need more of exactly what you're doing.
Pleasure talking to you, and good luck with teaching kids about science at COSI.
You got it. Well, listen, thank you very much again. It's been an absolute pleasure to be on your show. I threw something in the chat for you, just a couple of Dr. B in three episodes. The first one was on dark matter. These are 3-minute fun animated things. I would love your opinion on that. But with thank you so much for having me on. It's been a great conversation.
Great to talk to you.
All right.
I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Dr. B, and I'm sure you're going to give us some of your opinions. And like, I would love to know, how do we go wrong? How can we make it better? How do we reach across that divide to try and connect with the people who maybe we have disagreements with? And how can we get to this place of a better scientific understanding, if possible? I would love to know your thoughts and opinions. I'm going to give you some final thoughts, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Barely Groofing, Brian Bodie, Caradwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Bielek, Cy Nielsen, Dark Finger, David Giltonen, David Matz, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, James Clark, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Switz, Michael Purcell, Nordspace, OneStepForAnimals.org, Porobuck, Renkaidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Fathom-Munley, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, Wolfgang Klotz, and Zeldaborg Galactic Defender, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So obviously this is something that I'm very obsessed with. And, you know, I think as a person who has always been such a fan of science, I've read science fiction. I would read science textbooks for fun when I was a kid. Carl Sagan, Isaac Asimov, like all of these books I grew up with and were absolutely fascinated by the world around me and just sort of how much I love the natural world. It's heartbreaking to see just not only the conclusions made by large numbers of scientists, the scientific consensus getting undermined, but very much the process of science, of, you know, that getting good at something, understanding how something works, is seen now as a bad thing, this assault on expertise. And it haunts me. It really does. And I don't know what the answer is. And I know, you know, when I sort of think about what I said at the end of the interview with Dr. B there, I know that I don't know the answers to things. I have to remain in this kind of curious, open place, collecting information, slowly, carefully, gradually forming an opinion and doing what I can to try and push things in the what I think is the right direction, which is that science gets the job done and has gotten us to this place of all of these modern conveniences, and yet has risks and dangers. And only by understanding both sides of it, the good and the bad, can we progress as a civilization. And, you know, by turning our back on science is not going to do us any favors. All right. No answers today. Only questions. We'll see you next time.